Speed up with podcast speed up.
Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I'm your host, Julia Galef, and with me is today's guest, Professor Yuri Simonson. Yuri is an associate professor at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, and he blogs at Data Colada, which is a favorite blog among my data nerd friends and my social science friends. Yuri's research, I like to think of it as breaking down into two categories. On one level, Yuri researches factors that influence human decision-making, like, for example, the weather. So I think of that as the object level. And then on the meta level, Yuri researches the scientific method and problems in the scientific method that lead studies to be less reliable than we would ideally like, especially in social science and for example, psychology. So that's the part we're going to focus on in today's episode. For example, Yuri has been called the fraud vigilante for his work uncovering and explaining instances of fraud in social science. So we'll discuss that, but we'll also put it in the broader context of issues with the scientific method and maybe touch on the current replication crisis, the crisis of faith that's affecting psychology and social science in general that's been discussed in the news in recent weeks. So, Yuri, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
You know, one thing that you said last time we spoke was that there's a connection between those two levels that I termed the object and meta level of your research, in which on the object level, you're investigating biases in human judgment and decision-making or factors that can unconsciously influence our judgment. And then on the meta level, you're applying some of those principles, some of those findings to science itself, to the way that scientists think. Can you expand on that?
Yes. So I came to realize that after I had been doing work on methodology, but I saw the connection between those two areas that you described, which is that statistics textbooks tend to think of researchers the way economists used to think of people 50 years ago as purely rational maximizers and objective processors of information.
Right.
And economics went through a major revolution. Incorporating limited processing of information and then becoming more and more psychologically realistic. Mm-hmm. And statistics hasn't really gone through that. And so once you start thinking about researchers as being motivated thinkers who want to be successful, want to keep their careers, but also just believe that they're right, and that's why they're doing a study. They have a very clear expectation, and how that will tint how they interpret ambiguity that's present in any data analysis. You can really gain insight into how things go wrong and how to prevent them from going wrong.
So I think of the problems with the scientific method as falling into a few categories where one of the biggest categories is something sometimes called p-hacking, which we've talked about before on this show. And it basically entails ways that researchers can end up not necessarily intentionally, but get results that fit their hypothesis more than they would have if that p-hacking weren't happening. Mm-hmm. And then on a broader level, on an institutional level, there are ways that the process of by which studies get published can bias the field of published studies towards positive or exciting results. And we've talked about this as the file drawer effect or the publication bias effect on the show before. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so both of those categories seem like they fall under the umbrella of unconscious biases affecting the way that we do statistics and thereby what we conclude. And then the third category is outright fraud, where researchers are literally just fabricating data And so I'm guessing that doesn't fall, or maybe is there a connection between fraud and the kinds of judgment and bias research that you were referring to earlier, or would you put that in its own category?
I would put it outside of it. Most of the ways in which we relax how humans behave don't go all the way to criminal behavior or just unambiguously wrong behavior. And so I don't think, at least the training that I have or the research that I've read or created, gives you much insight into the mind of somebody who would go through an entire career creating false claims that she or him knows are false, and going to conferences, presenting them, writing papers, editing, responding to reviewers, and all that for a big fiction. I think that's more psychopathic. So maybe a clinical psychologist would be better equipped to think about that.
Right. And can you put these categories of problem in, can you compare them to each other in terms of the magnitude of the different problems? Like, how big of a problem is fraud relative to p-hacking or other unconscious influences on an individual researcher's work as compared to, say, publication bias and the way it affects which studies get published?
Right. So I think there's at least two main ways you could measure them. So how prevalent they are and how much impact they have. And so I think it's hard to tell. Most people say fraud is not very common, but what they really are saying is they hope it's not very common because they don't have any meaningful way of assessing it. It's very hard to do that. I suspect it's more common than most people describe it to be. So I would ballpark it. Basically, I think most people would ballpark it at trivially small, and I would say a substantial small share. Let's say, and it's, of course, it's necessarily a number out of thin air, but
sure,
just based on my experience, I would ballpark it closer to 5%.
Of studies. Studies are fraudulent?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, or contain fraudulent data. That'll be my rough estimate. And of course, there's a lot of guesswork in there.
Sure.
And if you ask most people would say, oh, maybe a handful of researchers are doing it. That's what I think would be the moral answer. What I do agree with the majority, and especially influential people who talk about this, is that I suspect very few ideas that are well known are based on fraudulent data. So I think most fraud tends to happen in the margins and on less important journals by less important people, and because that's where the incentives are, right? So if you can't be successful in any other way, and you can fake data in a journal that few people will ever read, then you can get away with it for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, it would be much more common, but less influential. And the only way in which fraud does have more of a burden on the rest of the scientific community is through two main ways, I think. One is through meta-analysis. So meta-analysis is this idea that when a literature is mature and you want to summarize it quantitatively, you go out and you try to find every study published and not published and try to aggregate it. And then, because fake data is not constrained by reality, they will often have just gigantic, enormous effects, and it can dramatically bias the overall literature. So even if you fake data and nobody ever reads your paper, you could still have an impact in the overall understanding of the literature, because somebody is going to include your extreme data point into an overall average, and you're going to have disproportionate weight. For a recent paper we had, we were trying to improve on a technique that we have to correct for p-hacking, mm-hmm. for selective reporting of analysis. And we simulated what would happen if you throw in the studies by one of the people that I caught committing fraud. And just one study by that person would make, if I remember correctly, if you take 20 studies that are all false positives, so none of them are real effects, it's just by chance they came about,
mm-hmm.
and you throw in just one fake study, it makes it almost certain that you would conclude the effect's real, because it's such an outlandishly large effect. So in that sense, I think fraud is potentially more consequential. I don't know if that answers the...
It
the angle that you were interested in.
Although I'm a little alarmed to learn that meta-analyses don't generally adjust for outliers. I would hope that they would.
They do, and yeah, there's a lot of variation in how to deal with it. And one problem is outliers are a really tricky problem in from the statistics standpoint, because you never know when you have an outlier if that's an anomaly or if that's really an extreme value.
Right.
And so there are ways to deal with it. One way, for example, that I've seen meta-analysis is they sort by the effect size across studies, and they'll show, so you will very easily see if there's an outlier, if there's an outlier value. But then it's not at all clear what to do with it. Is that the person who really understands the phenomenon? That's why they get a large effect. So you're right that it is possible to manage the problem in principle. I think in practice, people will be reluctant to say, we decided to exclude this result merely because it was large. It could easily be construed as you being biased against finding evidence for some phenomenon, for example.
Did you say there was another way to think about the size of the fraud problem?
Yeah, so and the other way I think it harms is that in terms of sort of so even if you're somebody doing work that is not very influential at all, you're taking a position, a faculty position or a research position that somebody else could take and that they would do good work or influential work. So if you think of people in the margins, and then you think of the big, the impact any one of them could have in their students and so on, that's what becomes more influential. So for example, I happened to, at a conference, run across a person who applied for the same job at the University of Michigan that the fraudster took. And for that person, the cost of fraud in science was very real, right? In that they didn't have a job at the University of Michigan because somebody who was faking data had it. And so that's like the human angle of it.
Right. So there are human victims, and then there's the general integrity of science victim, which is
right.
Maybe a more indirect but pretty substantial consequence. Is this just generally speaking what motivated you to go after the fraud problem, or was there some more specific impetus?
No, so for the fraud problem, we were working on something else, and we just stumbled on a period that was so incredibly, the effects were so incredibly large, so we were trying to figure out what was happening. And then, I think like most people who do any sort of science, intrinsic curiosity is primarily what drove it at the time. And I was just curious, if it were fake, how could you prove it? How could you provide evidence that it's fake?
Mm.
And then at that point, I shared the prior that this was very, very rare. So I thought, just because if you come across something that's so rare and so terrible, you should do something about it. If it happened today, I'm not sure I would react the same way, because now I no longer think it's such a rare thing.
Do you think this is a common reaction on the part of other social scientists, that they see surprising or surprisingly large effects and they think to themselves on some level, oh, that can't really be real, but you're the only one who really, or you're one of the few people who really tried to find out if it was real?
I don't know. There's been a few cases. I think some people perhaps are too quick to. I mean, after the papers where I described the fraud and how it was discovered and so on were published, I would receive a ton of emails from people from researchers and even data from political campaigns, electoral data, financial statements, and so on. And you can tell there's some people who are very quick to judge that something's fake because it's strikes them as surprising. So I don't know. I should say that as I'm an outlier in terms of how common fraud is. I know of two other people who have such negative views on this, and almost everybody, like 99.9% of people I know, think it's much less of a severe problem than I do. So,
well, one thing that I know you've talked about in the past is that it's troubling for social science that we can't just assume that a surprising result that we read in the literature is true and therefore interesting. We sort of have to have this prior that a surprising result, one that contradicts our expectations, there's a large probability that it's, if not fraudulent, then, you know, flawed research for other reasons. And it's sort of limits our ability to make updates from the research.
Right. But so my view on that has evolved a bit from, and here's, some people would, especially the more Bayesian oriented researchers, right, people who advocate for Bayesian methods, they would say, you really have to bring in your priors about phenomena before accepting it.
Yeah.
And I think the risk with that is that you end up being too skeptical of the most interesting work. And so you end up, in a way, creating an incentive to doing obvious and boring research. So I have a bit of a twist on that. In practice, it may be not sufficiently different, but I do think it is different, which is, I think we should bring in the priors and our general understanding and skepticism towards evaluating the methodology, almost blind to the question or the hypothesis that's being used. So let's say you tell me you run an experiment about how preferences for political candidates shift. Then I should bring into the table how easy it is to shift political preferences in general, how noisy those measures are, and so on. And not put too much weight on how crazy I think it is that you tell me you're changing everything by showing an apple below awareness, right? Because my intuition of how big the impact of apples below awareness are on people is not a very scientific prior. It's a gut feeling. And so then if I start judging your scientific evidence with my gut feelings, that doesn't seem right. But I probably do have a lot of experience, especially if I'm a political scientist or I'm an experimentalist, on how easy it is to move the dependent variable under different circumstances. So if you tell me, for example, if even though Likert scale is 1 to 7, how strongly do you agree with this or that? They sound kind of flaky, but when you work with them, you know that moving a Likert scale like that, more than say 1.5 or 2 points, is really, really hard.
And just to clarify, by moving the Likert scale 2 points, you mean trying an intervention that will cause people's average response on the 1 to 7 scale to move an average of 2 points.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. So it'd be like some people would show this and they said 4 on average, and people would say that and they say 6 on average, right? Okay. So 2 points. So if I read a paper that shows an effect of 3, say, my prior is you don't get that unless it's an incredibly obvious thing, like what's taller, right? A building or a house. And right. So unless you're asking an incredibly obvious question, I do allow myself to be skeptical, but not because the manipulation necessarily doesn't resonate with my intuition, right? So I don't know if the distinction is clear, but when it's my prior about the specific intervention you're claiming, there I try not to trust my intuition. And the other one is, what do I know about the reliability of the measures, how easy it is to move the dependent variable? And there I do, because in the latter case, it's based on data, and the other one is just my gut feeling. And if you want to be surprised by science and change your mind, then it's interesting if somebody comes up and shows something that you wouldn't expect and is reliable and replicable.
Well, to push this logic to the extreme, if we take a study that purports to show evidence for psi phenomena, for
right.
people being able to predict the future, for example,
surely
my intuition about the prior implausibility of that being real should factor in somehow, right? How could it not?
Yes. I think that one, the example is more of a gray area in terms of you could argue the hypothesis is so out there that your intuition about what moves things, it's not clear where the psychology starts and where sort of the methodology starts in terms of is precognition really a psychological phenomenon or does it challenge your understanding of how the world operates, right? I agree that your example challenges my description, which is loose and heuristic, right? But the idea is when you tell me about, let's say, preferences for how much people are willing to pay for shoes, right? And I may have an understanding of that, and I know how much it moves one way or the other, and that's what's constraining. And then if it's about an ad or if it's about experience, that's a thing I don't have a lot of beyond my loose intuition for. But in the case of precognition, it's about what changes dependent variables. And so from everything we understand, we know only thing that happened in the past can change dependent variables, no matter what the dependent variable is. Right? So imagine you thought precognition was possible, then whether it has to be arousing stimuli are only for men or for women, that part, I would not trust my intuition very much.
I see. So a lot of the frustration with psychology and social science in general has been directed at these kind of frivolous or sexy studies that will get reported in science news about, you know, I'm going to pull an example out of my lived experience in this very moment. So there's a window behind me and I can feel the sun on my back. So I could imagine a study of this kind showing that, oh, if there's a heater or the sun on someone's back, that will cause them to respond to surveys saying that their better days are behind them because they have this feeling of warmth and positivity being behind them, you know? So,
right. Mm-hmm.
And there's so many other studies that, I mean, the framework that I'm thinking of here is basically that our behavior and our choices and our view of the world can be strongly influenced by all sorts of random factors like women are more likely to wear red on days 6 through 14 of their menstrual cycle, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I do feel like my prior on that not being the case is certainly a weaker prior than my prior on precognition not being real. But it is, I do have a noticeable prior that's not really how the world works.
So let's go with the window behind you.
Okay.
Example. Where would we have an informed? I mean, what part of our experience would give us feedback as to whether windows behind us do or do not influence our perception? It's hard, right? So it sounds implausible, but that's just our gut reaction to it. A lot of really interesting findings in science, social and not social, seem crazy when we're presented with them. So I'm not challenging your instinct. I have the same instinct. They do sound far-fetched to me. But what I try to do is it's almost like exert self-control and say, okay, I'm going to suspend that prior and instead bring in this other prior, which is to ask, how big is your sample? And so, for example, those ovulatory cycle studies, if they had a really large sample, right, and they have a very carefully designed control group for both, and then you saw that they got the effect, and then the authors shared the very natural skepticism that any small cause would have a detectable effect, and so they went out and they carried out a very similar replication that addressed a natural concern you may have. If they did that, and so they addressed my priors in terms of methodology concerns, I would say there's good reasons to update my beliefs because I don't have well-founded beliefs about how different part phases of the ovulatory cycle influence female preferences for clothing. Like where would that prior come from? It's just my gut reaction to doesn't resonate with me, but it's not very well informed.
I suppose.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. In fact, now that I'm introspecting, I think that some of my skeptical prior about studies like that comes from the fact that I don't trust a lot of methods in social science. And mm-hmm. so basically I have this model where if a study is there are different reasons a study can become known to the public. Either it can be really well conducted and therefore published in a good journal and discussed by scientists and therefore more likely to filter into the public. Or it can be a sort of fun, sexy result. And that alone can be enough to propel it to public awareness. So mm-hmm. finding out that a study is sexy will make me somewhat less confident that it's true, I think. Sort of like, you know, if an actor can either achieve fame by being incredibly talented or by being incredibly attractive, and you know, if all you know that an actor is famous and attractive, that might cause you to downgrade your expectation of them being incredibly talented, that kind of thing.
Oh, so I think that's reasonable. So I think it's reasonable to say, the only thing I want to tell you is I have a very sexy finding. I'm not going to tell you any other details. It is perfectly rational to assume the methods are weak based on that information.
Right.
But then if you're so, okay, I'm going to evaluate. Now I'm going to open the paper and read it.
Right.
At what point should I challenge the findings, right? So I think this may be, I was just thinking this will be maybe a good example of the contrast between the two. So a few years ago, I did research evaluating claims that our names really impact what we end up doing. So if you have, for example, if your name is Smith, you're more likely to marry somebody else whose name is Smith. And if your name is Dennis, you become a dentist and so on. And my main reaction to it was, so they show that people tend to marry others with similar last names.
Okay.
And when I read the claim, I don't have a strong intuition about how we choose our partners and to what extent last names influence our perception of others. I don't have well-informed priors. But I do have on how difficult it is to show an effect is causal. And so I thought, I can't imagine a way to make this case compellingly. So even if it were true, how would you ever prove it to a convincing? So I was skeptical of the study for that reason. It just seemed like a very strong to document claim. And I ended up showing that all the evidence for it was spurious. But at least at that time, I wasn't necessarily a skeptic of the main hypothesis. I was just skeptical that you can easily document it. I think that makes sense. I think that captures my reaction to it.
Right. Good. So let's dive into the question of how to react when data are sort of too good to be true. So this was one of my intuitions about how to detect either fraudulent data or data that are just a serious victim of p-hacking or other kinds of cherry picking, that if the results are much stronger than we would expect, even if that effect were real, then that's a strong red flag. Does that seem fair to you?
Yeah. Yes. So fraud definitely, at least the fraud has been detected, and that's an important caveat, has that flavor that is usually too good to be true. But the caveat is we only know about the fraud we detect, and for you, we only catch very slow thieves kind of thing. And so it could be that there's very smart fraud out there that's hard to detect, and that it's not too big to be true, and we don't detect it. With p-hacking, with the selective reporting of analysis, it's often the opposite, where effects are just credible enough to, at least in terms of statistical significance, right? They're just below the p less than 0.05 threshold that we arbitrarily impose. So those are a little easier to spot, where if you're trying multiple things just to get, if you exclude some variables or some observations rather to get your effect, or if you try one versus the other measure to get your effect, you will tend to land just south of 0.05. And so that will make it easier to spot.
And can you tell the difference between data that's fraudulent and data that's maybe just the result of unconscious massaging on the part of the researchers? Is that detectable objectively?
So, I mean, the problem with fraud is that it doesn't, made up data doesn't follow any mathematical law, right? So it's just whatever you come up with. And so that's what makes detecting fraud tricky, that you can't, there's infinite ways to fake data. And so there are, let's say, five standard approaches to identifying data as problematic, and those are all very different from selective reporting of analysis. But you could very easily fake data so that it looks like it's being p-hacked instead of faked. So in fact, Dietrich Stapel, this famous psychologist from the Netherlands, who got caught a few years ago, and I was not involved in that case, he would describe that he would, when he would fake data, he would try to not make it look too good. He would consciously do that. He wasn't very good at it because his data did definitely look too good. But at least he was trying to. He was trying to not be too good to be true.
Well, I know that I've heard about methods exploiting the fact that humans don't really know what randomness looks like, for example. So you can sometimes look at, you know, the second digit after the decimal point to see if the frequency of different digits in that position is what you would expect generated by random chance alone, that kind of thing. Do you do anything like that? Or if not, how do you actually prove that something was fraudulent other than, I mean, it could fail to replicate, but that's not proof of fraud, right? So,
right. And in fact, it could successfully replicate, even though it was fraudulent. So in the work that I did, I did something that's similar to what Fisher did when analyzing Mendel's experiment, which I'm guessing a lot of your listeners will be familiar with that debate.
Why don't you recap it anyway?
So Fisher, who's one of the founding fathers of statistics, frequentist statistics, or p-values and so on, noticed a pattern in Mendel's genetic studies that was troubling, and that it was that Mendel's predictions were coming true too well in the sample. So you can say, even if Mendel were exactly right about the proportions of each trait that should be observed, the sample should have random error and they should deviate from those predictions. And they were systematically too similar to the predictions. Mm. And to the point where Fisher computed, okay, let's imagine the theory was right. How likely would you be to get this good evidence or better? It's like the opposite of the p-value, which asks, how likely is it if your theory is wrong, that if your theory is right, you'd be this far from the theory? Fisher was asking, how likely would you be to be this close to the theory?
Mm.
And he concluded that Mendel's data were impossibly similar to the predictions. And there's been debate that at least 4 or 5 years ago, there was a paper in statistics where they're debating if it was right or fraud, or if it was selective reporting in this case. So some of the analysis I did were of that flavor, where I found that the samples in the studies just didn't have enough variation. Another way to detect fraudulent, so that's data not fulfilling expectation mathematical properties. But they can also deviate in terms of more conceptual or psychological properties. So if you know a domain, you know that data behave in certain ways. So for example, if you ask people how much they're willing to pay for things, they tend to, which people in my field do a lot, as a way to capture how much people value things, how much they like them, or how they liking or interest changes with my different shocks. If you ask people how much they pay for things, they tend to answer in multiples of 5 or 10. And if you were to fake data and you aren't aware of that, you may say, oh, people valued T-shirt and they said they would pay $17, $18, $12, and not have that very marked tendency. And so one of these cases, I collected valuation data from 20 different studies, and all of them had very, very, very pronounced spikes at the multiples of 5.
Mm-hmm.
And his data, there were 0 of it. But then I ran a replication of his study, and not only did I not get the effect he got, but I did get spikes at multiples of 5.
Right.
And so that was additional evidence that the data were not... I think this is a euphemism, but... people use quite a bit. The data were not collected as described in the article.
That is a very... I was going to say that was the smoking gun, but that's also a way to describe it. I have to say, listening to this is making me... It's making me feel the way I feel when I watch like a crime procedural and the detectives come up with all sorts of clever ways to finger the culprit even though he thinks he's covered his tracks. And my reaction is always, God, I'm never going to commit a crime because there's no way that I would know everything I had to do in order to get away with it. There's always something I'm going to forget or slip up. And as you talk, I'm thinking, man, I'm never going to make up data because there's no way I'd get away with it.
Yeah, it's funny. So when I was working on this, when I haven't for a couple of years, but when I was, statisticians would say, oh, I don't know, they're so dumb. It would be so easy to fake undetectably. And they would go on to describe something. I know. They would go on to describe something and be like, oh, they'll be totally detectable. So for example, they would say, oh, you just generate random data with even in Excel, just use the normal distribution and generate random data. And I would say, yeah, but if you used it, for example, for valuations, you would immediately get caught because they don't follow the normal distribution, right? They bump at 5. So I do think it's possible to fake undetectably. I think it's very hard to do it at your first attempt. And if you don't have feedback, right? If you don't have somebody saying, oh, this is how I would get you. This is how I would get you. I think it's actually way harder than it seems.
So let's talk briefly about solutions. One solution... Mm-hmm. Category that has come up before is the idea of pre-registering. So getting researchers to state ahead of time what effect they're looking for and what methods they're going to use to test for that effect.
Right.
And the pessimism that I've heard from people and that I kind of feel as well about that solution is just that the incentives aren't really there. You know, that as long as journals are going to keep publishing non-pre-registered studies, what benefit is there to researchers to, you know, tying their hands out of time when they could, you know, otherwise leave themselves free to kind of data mine and cherry pick until they, you know, get something publishable. What do you think?
Right. Yeah. So, one big distinction is that pre-registration is all about selective reporting of analysis, p-hacking, but it won't do anything with fakery, right? If you're faking, right. You can pre-register, right, you'll sure. get it no matter what. So my view has evolved on pre-registration. I used to be quite skeptical, but and now I'm enough of a supporter that I co-created a website for pre-registration that's called aspredicted.org. And so when we created that, part of the reason was we did see a selfish incentive for pre-registering your studies. And it is that once the readers of your work have become more skeptical and you know, justifiably so more educated about how selective reporting matters, they will start looking for signs that you selectively reported. And so if you don't selectively report, if you are transparent, then you need a way to signal that you are transparent. And the pre-registration becomes a little bit like the organic label in the organic farmer apple, right? So if I want to create that apple, that it's harder to produce, more expensive, and it's smaller, how do I get credit for it? Well, I label it, right? I was just completing a paper where we have a pre-registered study, and we had collected three variables, three alternative measures. And one of them, we thought, I actually disagree with my co-authors. I thought it wouldn't work, and they thought it would. And so if you're worried about people worrying that you p-hack, you may choose not to collect that variable to avoid any suspicion. Instead, we pre-registered that we care really about two variables, and this third variable was exploratory, and we were not going to include it in our analysis. And so pre-registration bought us the freedom to include things in our study that we were not planning on reporting in this study, but we wanted to use to inform future research. So I think it signals where you're not selectively reporting, and it allows you to collect additional information that or designs that you wouldn't normally collect. And so we launched aspredicted.org on December 1st, and it has over 100 authors who've contributed a pre-registration already, which is, we're very excited about that.
Oh, that's wonderful. Are you actively trying to increase its adoption in the field?
So it's growing fast enough that we haven't done any. We basically had a blog post about it and tweeted about it, and there's an aspect of the design that's kind of viral that we didn't build it in, but we got lucky about it, which is all authors have to approve any given pre-registration. And so if I'm co-authoring with somebody and I pre-register it, they all get emails and they find out about it. And so I think it's spreading through that, I don't know, the way like Hotmail back in the day spread out, which you would get those emails, people saying came from Hotmail. So I think it's having that, not by design, but by chance. So
or like, you know, playing Candy Crush on Facebook. Would you like to to show your friends your wonderful success at Candy Crush? Yes or no?
Right, right.
Except, you know, for good instead of evil.
And I suspect once a few papers start coming out with that, we worked really hard to make it incredibly simple to use and to enforce. So the idea would be there are other options for people to pre-register their studies, but it's very costly as a reader to check if the things were done as predicted, as pre-registered, because it can be like a 40-page document. We have a single-page document. So the idea is that every reader should, within a minute, be able to compare the study that was published with the study that was pre-registered.
So at this point, I'd like to dive into the current replication crisis in psychology. Obviously, the problems with social science have been discussed for years now, but the recent context is that there was a paper published in Science a few months ago titled "Estimating the Reproducibility of Psychological Science," in which the authors took 100 papers from the psychology literature and tried to replicate them. And they found that only 40% of those papers actually replicated, meaning that in only 40 of the cases were they able to find the same effect that the original study found. So this has caused much gnashing of teeth and wailing and rending of garments in the social science world over the last few months. But the most recent update to the debate was a commentary published a few weeks ago by a couple of social scientists saying, you know, this actually isn't that bad. There are a bunch of reasons why studies can fail to replicate, even if the effect is real. So, you know, this 40% figure shouldn't actually be that troubling. There's no real replication crisis. And Yuri, I was hoping you could speak to this particular issue and talk about whether, in fact, you think this 40% figure is troubling or not. And then maybe more broadly about the process of replicating in general. How concerning is it when you try to replicate a study and fail to find the same effect? What should we conclude from that?
So starting with the specifics of this of the original paper and the critique, I was recently having a conversation with somebody and we came up with a good analogy for it, which is the original paper said 40% of studies replicated. So that would be, imagine I tell you that in soccer playoffs, this team won 40% of games. You'll be forgiven for assuming that, oh, they must have lost the other 60% because you can't tie in a playoff. But it turns out that in soccer playoff, because there's two games, you can tie any given game. And so then if I tell you, well, they won 40%, they tied 30%, and they lost 30%, you'll be surprised by that. And even there was no ill intent on my part, I just didn't realize you didn't know about soccer rules. So I think the original paper said 40% of studies replicated. They didn't say that 60% failed to replicate, but a lot of people interpret it that way. And that's not right. And that's not a good read. That's not a justified read of the evidence. The justified read of the evidence is 40% replicated, 30% didn't, and 30% we really can't tell one way or the other. And so I think that's part of the discussion. Some people have used a Bayesian approach to think of the problem. I've used a different approach. It doesn't really matter as long as you're willing to accept that sometimes a study is inconclusive as opposed to supporting or not supporting a conclusion. You will conclude because so many of the studies had small samples that the replication were just inconclusive. So if we take the evidence of that, 40% of success, 30% failure, 30% unknown, that seems to me that's probably better than I would have expected. So I find
pessimistic about the social.
I am unusually pessimistic, yeah. But I think I don't know. I think if you people who are in the in this business of trying to improve the how science gets reported, I think it seems. And part of the reason is it's really hard, and that's the other part of the critique, is that it's hard to really replicate a study in one of the things, hard things about social science is that facts are so context, affected by context and also by measurement. So you can have a study and then you run it very similarly, but you run across a problem that was just not present in the original. So for example, you can get a floor effect, which is used in psychology a lot and a little bit in economics, where all the responses are so low that you just can't get any lower than that. And so you fail to replicate it, right? You just can't detect anything. And because it's social science as opposed to hard science, harder sciences, the floor, it's going to be dependent on the sample. So maybe if you ask Americans today, the floor is in one place. And if you ask Swedish people 2 years ago, the floor is a completely different place. And so that doesn't really falsify the psychological hypothesis. It just means you have to adjust your measures, your sample size, or who your sample is. And so even if all effects were true, just these factors, and this is the biggest debate, right? Whenever somebody publishes a failure to replicate in psychology, the original authors typically will say, well, it's because there's this big factor that changed between my sample and your sample. And that's easy to get into unfalsifiable explanations. But on the other hand, we don't know when that's true, but we know that that's true sometimes. And so 30% failure is not terrible. Because of that reason, because I wouldn't say, that's not my estimate of how many of the hypotheses were wrong. Right? It's maybe an upper bound of that.
Although I can imagine other factors that should make us more pessimistic about that 30% figure instead of more optimistic. Like tell me if I'm wrong here, but it seems to me that there might be just a regression to the mean effect where if there's random variation in how strong the effect seems when you do a study, and you end up publishing when something, when the effect is unusually or abnormally strong, then the next time you look for that effect, its chances are it's going to seem weaker because you published when it was strong.
Yeah, and people do raise that response, which is to say, it's true that things change in social science, but why do they always change for the worse? Why can it be that 2 years ago in Sweden, it was really hard to get the effect, and today in the US, it's very easy to get the effect?
Yeah.
And that's fair. That's fair. But even if that were the case, out of that 30%, right, so when the effect gets stronger, you detected it before and you continue to detect it. I'm thinking as I speak. When the original author gets unlucky because of publication bias, we don't make a record of it. So we're not compensating hypotheses that we thought were false and then we realize were true. So to some extent, it's still only working against you, right? In the sense that if it helps you replicate, we counter replication. Among those failures, some of them must be explained by when it got weaker. Now, I'm not trying to underestimate how I think it's a serious problem. I think the solution is disclosing how studies are run, pre-registration, more replication, and so on. I'm completely on board with all of those things. But we don't have to convince people that only 40% of studies replicate to make that case. Even if 80% of them replicate, we want to know which ones are more likely to replicate. And the best way to do it is to report studies with the least selectivity of reporting as possible.
Right. Another bias that occurs to me that might exist here is a kind of status quo bias, in which I think it was actually Andy Gelman who made this point that I might be stealing here, where he says, well, you know, if we have a study that gets published and it shows an effect, and then we try to replicate it and the result is inconclusive, we still sort of assume, you know, well, it's probably true because we didn't disprove it. But if we imagine the order of those studies being reversed, where the replication, so to speak, was actually the first study and it found no effect, and then we did a second study that found an effect, wouldn't we be differently anchored? Like, wouldn't we be... Our default assumption would not be that this effect is there, right? We would just think,
yeah, I think
two studies.
I like the point, and I like the way of building the argument, and I think it's true. And in particular, I think if somebody has a study and it fails to replicate, I don't think it should be enough to say, oh, these three other things changed. I think unless it is just blatantly obvious that those things really matter, and of course it was incompetently performed, if unless you can really have that strong an argument, you should go out and test as the person who wants to continue believing in the effect. You should go out and show that moderator, that other variable that changed, really is important. So I agree with that, but there's a way to turn the argument on its head and argue the other way, which is if the failure to replicate had come first, right, almost surely the author who ran it would have run a follow-up study. So when I run a study and it fails, I don't abandon the project. I look at the data and I see, did I measure things correctly? Maybe I should design a stronger manipulation. Maybe I should use a larger sample and so on. But if the replicator doesn't do that, right? The replicator, when the replicator fails to obtain a result, that's where the project ends for the most part. And so if we're going to treat replications as if they had come first, we should look closer at things like, do you replicate, for example, the range of values of the dependent variable is where it should be. Any sort of quality check that you do apply on the data, is the quality check similar in the replication as it is in the original? Or forget the original, is the quality check sufficiently high for us to put trust on it? So I think the argument, it's a good one, and 80% argues against original authors being so defensive about replications and dismissing them so quickly. But part of it also argues for original authors try hard to get effects, and not in the bad sense of the word, in the sense of really understanding what's happening. And replicators are not intrinsically interested in the subject typically.
Right.
And so when they don't get it, they think it's case closed.
Right. Well, I think what I want to use my last question for is a general takeaway for our listeners about how much to trust different levels of evidence in social science. For a long time, I've been skeptical of single studies. For the most part, I'm not going to trust a single study, in isolation, without knowing the context and what other studies have investigated the same phenomenon, unless it's a just really, really well done study. And then for a lesser amount of time, I've been skeptical of meta-analyses, which, as you noted earlier in the episode, can be influenced by things like outliers, which may or may not be fraudulent, and they have other problems as well. But then more recently, I would have said, well, maybe we can't trust individual studies, maybe we can't trust a meta-analysis, but surely we can trust a consensus that's been around for over two decades, in which study after study after study and multiple meta-analyses shows again and again this phenomenon exists. But one of the subfields, one of the consensus in social science that has been prominent in this crisis of faith in psychology has been the idea of ego depletion, which is that your willpower can be sort of used up in a local, like over a short period of time. And so you want to sort of conserve willpower by, not trying to stick to your diet when you also have to stick to a really hard task at work or something like that. So that was a consensus, and now it's been cast into doubt by attempts to replicate it that have failed. And so I'm wondering, Yuri, if you have any general heuristics for, should the takeaway from the problems with social science that we've been talking about be that you just have to retain a high level of skepticism about everything, or are there some kinds of research or some levels of evidence that we can be pretty confident in?
So I think whenever it's a high bar, I guess, to some extent, but whenever a skeptic replicates the effect, that's a good, right? So whenever somebody has all the psychological reasons to not find it, when they find it, I think it's there's going to be a small share, but that's something that it's definitely the rational thing to do is to update in light of that evidence. And then, right, so that can be attained. And maybe that's the standard we should aspire just most findings to have, which is don't take them too seriously until a lab that's not really intrinsically interested shows the effect.
I've heard of something called adversarial. Yeah. Is it adversarial mm-hmm. research? I forget the name, but basically two
adversarial
labs.
Adversarial collaboration.
Yes, thank mm-hmm. you. Two labs, one which believes the effect is real and one which believes it isn't, collaborate and sort of agree ahead of time on a protocol, set of research methods, and then report their results. That seems promising. Is that common?
It's rare.
Yeah.
And I've spoken to some people who've done it, and they don't like it as much as
<I'm>
people who haven't done it like it. And I think part of the reason is that, and this goes back to the point about how replicators and original authors react differently to when their studies don't work. It is hard to understand things. And so when you're running a study and it doesn't come as expected, you immediately see problems that you hadn't seen before. And part of it is self-deception, and it's bad. But part of it is, when you really need to figure something out, that's when you figure it out. And if you talk to any creator of a successful idea, if you tell them if they got it right away, they will say almost invariably no, that they had a lot of failed attempts until they figured it out. And so I think one problem with adversarial collaboration is that it assumes that after one study, your beliefs will immediately update. And usually the moment the adversarial collaboration collects the data, whichever side didn't get exactly what they expected, they will see a problem they hadn't seen before. And that doesn't need to be disingenuous or bad. That's just a natural process of updating our understanding. And so, I don't know. I social science doesn't usually deal with urgent matters. So I think it's fine for us to say, I don't really understand why the newspapers have to cover studies the moment they come out. I think they wait 4 years until somebody, an opposing side, shows the effect too. I think nothing bad will happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's partly a coordination problem, right? That
they're just trying to beat everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Although I think there's also some weird psychological quirk where people are more interested in something that's new, even if, you know, there's all this other news, all this other science that they haven't heard of before that isn't new. It's just been sitting around in textbooks for decades. And it's not quite clear why they should be more excited about the thing that was just discovered than the thing that was, you know, discovered ages ago that they'd never heard of before.
And I suspect, I mean, if this is a, you know, falsifiable prediction, but I suspect that if you want to run the experiment, there'll be very little benefit of reporting on a recent study versus an old study. And so I suspect
of page views?
If readership, mm-hmm. right. So I think if the New York Times tomorrow reported on a very sexy finding from 5 years ago, I don't think it would have any fewer readers than if it's a new study. In fact, maybe more, because nobody else will be reporting on it. And because it will require readers to be so sophisticated that they remember all these different findings and their subtleties of how they're different, and they don't. And so, in fact, because I was involved in the debunking of those name studies, I have a Google alert on them. And periodically, at least once a year, somebody writes a story in a major outlet about them, and they're 14 years old. But if you say people choose whom to marry based on their name, your first reaction is not, wait, is that a recent finding or is that an old finding? Right?
That's true. That's interesting. I had just taken this as a given that people want to read new stuff, but maybe this is an assumption on the part of the media that isn't fully warranted. I'll have to think about that.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be interesting to test. I suspect that, isn't there, I know I can't quite remember the details, but a newspaper who ran the same editorial cartoon many days in a row to see if people would notice?
No, I haven't heard about that.
Oh, that's a little different. That's about people actually reading it.
Yeah.
But I suspect, actually, now I'm very curious, and it would be worth testing it.
Cool. Well, we are actually quite over time. I gave in to temptation to continue the conversation, but I'm going to force myself to wrap things up now, and we'll move on to the Rationally Speaking pick. Welcome back. Every episode of Rationally Speaking, we invite our guest to introduce the pick of the episode. That's a book or website or movie that has influenced their thinking in some way. Yuri, what's your pick for today's episode?
So my pick is by Paul Meehl, who was a psychologist at the University of Minnesota, and he gave his last PhD seminar in 1989, and somebody videotaped it. And they put all the videotapes, all the recordings online for download. And it's about these PhD seminars in the philosophy of science. And what makes it really interesting is that Meehl puts psychology within the bigger picture of science in a way that I don't think anybody's doing anymore. So he would put all of our approach to understanding psychological phenomena from the perspective of understanding scientific phenomena more generally. And to find it, your listeners can go to University of Minnesota and search for Paul Meehl, which is spelled M-E-E-H-L. And I've also made a quick URL with the same files in MP3 format if they just want to listen to it. And the URL is tinyurl.com/SimonsonPick, my last name, Pick.
Excellent. Well, Yuri, thank you so much for joining us. This was a fascinating discussion. And I'll link to both Data Colada and also your pick on the Rationally Speaking website.
Great. Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
This concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.